Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On October 10, 2007, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Medean v. Texas case. The court grappled with two main questions. 1. Did the President of the United States act within his constitutional and statutory foreign affairs authority when he determined that the states must comply with the United States treaty obligation to give effect to the Avena judgment in the cases of the 51 Mexican nationals named in the judgment? And 2. Are state courts bound by the U.S. Constitution to honor the undisputed international obligation of the United States, under treaties duly ratified by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate, to give effect to the Avena judgment in the cases that the judgment addressed? In this episode of SCOTUSCast, Texas Solicitor General Ted Cruz, who argued the case on behalf of the state of Texas, offers his analysis of the case. As always, the Federal Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Texas Solicitor General Ted Cruz.
This morning, Wednesday, October 10th, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in the case of Medellin v. Texas. This case implicates every conceivable axis of separation of powers and federalism. It implicates the limitations on the President's authority vis-a-vis Congress, the limitations on the President's authority vis-a-vis the U.S. Supreme Court, international law vis-a-vis domestic law, the federal government vis-a-vis the states, and, with what I like to call a Mobius twist, the authority of the President vis-a-vis the state judiciary. The case began 14 years ago, in 1993, when two teenage girls, age 14 and 16, had the unfortunate happenstance to take a shortcut walking home from a friend's house. They stumbled into a gang initiation in northwest Houston, and six gang members proceeded to gang rape those two teenage girls for over an hour, and then to murder them both. Within a few days, all of the gang members were apprehended. They confessed, they were convicted, and they were sentenced to death. One particular gang member, the subject of this case, is Jose Ernesto Medellin. Medellin confessed in writing after waiving his Miranda rights in writing. He admitted gang raping both girls, and he described how the girls pleaded for their lives before he strangled them with a shoelace and a belt. His conviction was affirmed on direct review all the way up. Then, on state habeas, Medellin introduced a new claim into his case. For the first time, he brought a claim under the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs. This treaty, ratified in 1969, provides that foreign nationals have a right to contact their consulate if they are arrested in a foreign nation, and that the arresting authorities are obliged to inform the national of that right. There's no dispute that the local police officers failed to inform Medellin of his rights under the Vienna Convention, even though, because he was born in Mexico, he is technically speaking a foreign national. Medellin had lived virtually his entire life in the United States, spoke, read, and wrote English, and was educated his entire life in U.S. public schools, but, technically speaking, he was a Mexican national. The ordinary rule of criminal procedure, applicable with respect to constitutional claims, applicable with respect to statutory claims, is that if a criminal defendant fails to raise them at trial, those claims are forfeited. They are defaulted. That is the usual rule of criminal procedure. And in 1998, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Bayard case held that claims under the Vienna Convention are very much the same. Just like claims under the United States Constitution, if a defendant fails to raise them at trial, that defendant cannot raise them years later on habeas and seek to disturb their conviction or sentence. Medellin's claim under the Vienna Convention was rejected on the basis of the Supreme Court's Briard holding. At this point, the case takes an unusual turn, because the nation of Mexico sued the United States in the International Court of Justice, the World Court, which is the judicial arm of the United Nations. The basis of Mexico's suit was Medellin's conviction and that of 50 other Mexican nationals on death row throughout the United States, all of whom had not been notified of their rights to contact their consulate under the Vienna Convention, and nearly all of whom had procedurally defaulted those claims. The World Court, in turn, ruled for the nation of Mexico. It issued an order unprecedented in the annals of history. It ordered the United States to review and reconsider the convictions and death sentences of all 51 Mexican nationals on death row. At no time in our over 200 years of history has a foreign tribunal asserted the authority to directly intrude into the U.S. justice system, much less to disturb final criminal judgments. Medellin's case at the time was before the Fifth Circuit, and when he appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court took the case as the first case following the ICJ's decision in Avena, Avena being the name of the case between Mexico and the United States. Then, on February 28, 2005, on the eve of argument in what is now called Medellin 1, the United States filed a brief before the Supreme Court that did two things. One, it supported the state of Texas and agreed that Medellin's claim was not cognizable in federal courts. And two, it appended a two-paragraph memorandum that the president had signed earlier that day. That memorandum, addressed to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and signed by President George W. Bush, provides that the president had determined that the U.S. would comply with the World Court decision, and therefore the president was directing that the state courts review and reconsider the convictions and death sentences of all 51 Mexican nationals. It was, as the Department of Justice explicitly concedes, an unprecedented action. The executive branch asserted the authority to unilaterally, through a two-paragraph memorandum to a member of the cabinet, set aside any state laws that contradicted the executive's views of international comity. Remarkably, the Department of Justice explicitly disclaimed any reliance on the underlying treaties, the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs, the Optional Protocol, or the United Nations Charter, all of which the United States signed, all of which the U.S. Senate ratified, but all of which the U.S. Department of Justice agrees, are not self-executing in the sense that none of them can be judicially enforced in U.S. courts. That's been the position of the United States for over four decades. Republican and Democratic administrations have agreed that these treaties are not judicially enforceable, and the United States continues to maintain that these treaties are not judicially enforceable, and that the World Court's Avena decision is not judicially enforceable, except concerning these 51 Mexican nationals, and then only because the president has chosen to order the state courts to obey the World Court decision. Because of the presidential memorandum, Medellin filed a subsequent state habeas application in state court. And given that subsequent state habeas application, which could conceivably have provided Medellin the relief he sought, the U.S. Supreme Court dismissed Medellin 1 as improvidently granted. By a vote of 5-4, in effect, it threw out Medellin's appeal. It dismissed Medellin's appeal and concluded his first federal habeas challenge. Back before the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals faced a statute that regulates its jurisdiction. By statute, the Texas legislature has prescribed that the Texas state courts lack jurisdiction over a successive habeas claim unless it raises a claim based on a legal basis that could not have been raised before on a new legal basis. And so the operative question before the Court of Criminal Appeals was twofold. One, is the decision by the International Court of Justice in Avena a legal basis sufficient to grant Medellin relief? Or two, is the President's memorandum a legal basis sufficient to grant Medellin relief? At the end of the day, the Texas State Court unanimously concluded that it lacked jurisdiction to grant Medellin's subsequent habeas application because neither the Avena decision nor the President's memorandum was binding federal law. The state court further concluded that the President's order exceeded his authority under the U.S. Constitution. Accordingly, it unanimously struck down the President's memorandum. Medellin filed for certiorari, and the U.S. Supreme Court granted cert. Today, that case was argued. Unlike Medellin 1, where the United States supported Texas, in today's argument, the United States Department of Justice found itself in the unusual position of being allied with José Ernesto Medellin, the admitted child rapist and murderer. And the state of Texas found itself in the unusual position of opposing the United States, and in particular arguing, as the state court had unanimously concluded, that the President's memorandum exceeded his authority under the United States Constitution. This case, in our judgment, raises fundamental questions about separation of powers and federalism. Questions about the basic limitations on government authority that protect the liberty of all the citizens. The President's memorandum, Texas argued, violates the Constitution in three respects. First, it intrudes upon the authority of the United States Congress. When the U.S. Senate ratified the treaties at issue, it did so under the very clear understanding that these treaties were not self-executing. Now, to be not self-executing in this context, what that means is those treaties cannot be enforced in United States courts. Indeed, the Senate was told by the administration at the time that these treaties would not alter or affect U.S. law, and that has been the consistent position of every State Department from the day these treaties were signed until today. The import of the power asserted in this case is that the President would have the unilateral authority to take a non-self-executing treaty obligation, an obligation that does not have domestic force in U.S. courts, and to unilaterally render that obligation self-executing. If the President has that power, the consequences are broad. That same asserted authority could arguably allow future presidents to set aside future state laws that they believed were inconsistent with their visions of international comity. The United States has ratified a great number of treaties with broad, generic provisions such as the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, which guarantees to every individual a right to personal dignity. Now, when the Senate ratified that, it was explicit that that treaty was not self-executing, which means that a plaintiff can't go to court and litigate his or her right to personal dignity. A criminal defendant cannot litigate his or her treaty right to personal dignity because it's not self-executing. It is not enforceable in U.S. courts. Under the power asserted by the Department of Justice in Medellin versus Texas, a subsequent president could decide unilaterally, in aid of international comity, to treat that non-self-executing treaty obligation as binding, and to order the state courts to set aside whatever state law he or she believed was inconsistent with that broad treaty obligation. potential state laws that one could imagine a subsequent president targeting include state laws regulating environmental emissions or regulating tort liability on the one hand, or state laws regulating marriage and adoption and the death penalty. Now, regardless of what one thinks about the policy merits of all of those state laws, be they laws of the state of California or Texas or New York or Alabama, under our democratic system, the president lacks authority to, through writing a two-paragraph memo to a member of his cabinet, set aside a state law he or she deems inconsistent with his or her policy preferences. The second fundamental failing of the president's order is that it contravenes the authority of the Supreme Court of the United States. Just last term, in the Sanchez-Yamez case, the Supreme Court explicitly concluded that the Avena decision, the World Court decision at issue in Medellin, is not enforceable in U.S. courts. Nevertheless, the Department of Justice is going before the state courts and arguing that the state courts, when faced with two potential sources of authority, one, a majority opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States, and two, a two-paragraph memorandum from the President to the Attorney General, should obey the latter and disregard the former, and in particular, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's holding that as a matter of federal treaty law, these treaties are not enforceable in federal or state court, should conclude because of the President's order that with respect to these 51 Mexican nationals, the treaty rights are enforceable. That argument, Texas urges, is contrary to the basic responsibilities of the judiciary under Article 3 of the Constitution. It is not often in litigation that one gets to cite as a major precedent Marbury versus Madison. But as Chief Justice John Marshall observed, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is. And just last term, the Supreme Court said what federal law was with respect to these treaties. The President lacks the unilateral authority to change that determination. Finally, the President's order contravenes the sovereignty of the states. The President's order does not purport to regulate individuals, which is the usual object of federal government legislation or regulation. Rather, the President's order is directed specifically to the state judiciary, and as such, it commandeers those judges. It doesn't provide a general federal rule of law that is enforceable in state and federal courts alike. Rather, it explicitly targets the state judiciary and instructs the state judges to go back and reopen final cases, decide them again, decide them differently, and set aside any state law to the contrary. Under long-standing U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that exceeds the authority of the executive. In addition to the questions about the President's order, the oral argument focused considerably today upon Medellin's argument that the Avena decision is a judgment that binds the United States and leaves no discretion for the U.S. Supreme Court to question its reasoning with respect to these 51 Mexican nationals. Texas argued vigorously that that interpretation fundamentally undermines the sovereignty of the United States, that under our Constitution, the role of saying what the law is, of interpreting federal treaty law, cannot be given to any foreign tribunal, but it remains under the Constitution exclusively the role of one Supreme Court of the United States. Beyond that, Texas urged, the treaties don't even purport to do that. By their text, the treaties provide that when the International Court of Justice rules, the remedy for enforcing that judgment is not going to a domestic court. It is resort to the Security Council. By definition, a political and diplomatic remedy. Indeed, the International Court of Justice has been used over the years precisely to resolve political and diplomatic disputes. Thus, in the 1980s, when the Nicaraguan Civil War was underway, the nation of Nicaragua sued the United States in the International Court of Justice for mining the harbors there when the United States was supporting the Contras in that war. The International Court of Justice ruled against the United States, and President Reagan made the decision, as was his prerogative, to ignore the decision of the International Court of Justice. That's the consequence of a decision of a court being political and diplomatic. Ordinarily, these decisions are respected because they are matters of negotiations between the nations that signed the treaties. In the Nicaragua case, President Reagan made the determination as a matter of foreign policy that the United States would not comply. Conversely, in the 1970s, when the nation of Iran seized our hostages, the United States sued Iran in the International Court of Justice. Now, when the United States did so, we didn't for a moment think that if and when we won in the World Court, that that order would suddenly force Iran and force Iranian courts to release the hostages. We understood that Iran was unlikely to give any force to the ICJ determination. But the decision was made. It was helpful politically and diplomatically to take the matter to the body and receive an adjudication that could be used in the political and diplomatic realm. The argument today seemed to go well. Any litigator naturally is cautious about predicting an outcome. But I can say that Texas is hopeful and optimistic, and at a minimum, we believe strongly that the Constitution and long-standing precedent of the U.S. Supreme Court supports the position Texas urged today. This case is about the very basic limitations on the power of government. It's about ensuring that world court decisions are not accorded an authority greater than decisions of U.S. domestic courts, about ensuring that the world court cannot, in effect, overrule the Supreme Court of the United States. It is also about ensuring that the executive branch cannot unilaterally set aside state laws inconsistent with any particular president's policy preferences. As Madison famously explained in the Federalist Papers, power in our government is divided between three branches in the federal government and between the national government and the states. And by dividing the power, the Constitution protects the liberty of everyone. Texas will wait with anticipation to see how the Supreme Court rules in Medellin versus Texas.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.